the other half tonight. And with that, I would like to give you Bob Tate.
Thank you, Ursel. My name is Bob, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. And this is a long-anticipated joy for Betsy and myself. Larry first invited me to be here. It must be well over a year and a half ago. It's the longest future invitation I've ever received in AA, and so I've literally been anticipating very excitedly, really, being here for all that while. And I'm grateful to you, Larry, and to all of the committee for making it possible for Betsy and me to be here. It's a beautiful place, as Betsy mentioned today. We really haven't been in West Virginia before to speak of, except just to drive through a little part of it. And this is a simply tremendous experience. What a beautiful place and what a beautiful day this has been. I'm grateful, too, to Bill Bailey for picking us up at the airport and sort of making sure that everything's been taken care of since we've been here. My home group is the Wednesday night group in Greenwich, Connecticut, which is where I sobered up and where I still go to my AA meetings. People continually refer to us as being from New York. We aren't really from New York. I don't live in New York at all. I live in Connecticut, and I work in New York, and that's somewhat different. I'm also a member of the 468 group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that gets its name from 468 Park Avenue South, which is the address of your general service office, which is where I work. That meeting meets at 11 a.m. on every Friday, and it consists of the 15 or so members of Alcoholics Anonymous who work at the General Service Office. These are the staff members that some of you are familiar with. I think that a lot of you have mentioned how much you enjoyed Betty Little, who was the last one here. And incidentally, I'm grateful for that, too, to the committee for frequently including the staff members and people from the General Service Office at this gathering, because believe me, if we just sat up there in the ivory tower, you know, and did our thing all day long every day, we really wouldn't know what's going on in AA, because that isn't AA. This is AA. Well, even this isn't AA. Really, AA is the groups. The groups. That's really where it's all at. And unless we, you know, spend some time on our weekends visiting with all you folks, why, you know, we'd get out of touch in an awful hurry, and that would just never do. So I'm grateful to you for that. And thanks also for, in behalf of all of us, for the collection tonight for the general service. That's a beautiful thing to do, and thank you very much. You can remember, if you will, that whatever you put into that bucket tonight is going to be used to support the work of carrying the message to still suffering alcoholics really all over the world. Because even though in many, many other countries, you know, we have 26,000 groups of Alcoholics Anonymous that are now listed at the General Service Office in New York. And that's just in the United States and Canada. And there's at least another 15 or 20,000 groups overseas. And they're in 110 different countries. Isn't that fabulous? You talk about starting with just two people from Vermont. And here AA is really everywhere where there are people, really. In fact, in about 25 or 26 of those countries, they have a general service office, and they have publishing and everything just exactly the same as we do in this country. It's absolutely amazing. And they extend all the way from northern Greenland to the Antarctic. And that's literally true. Clear down at the South Pole, there's a regularly listed Alcoholics Anonymous group. And it meets on Tuesdays and Saturdays, if you're going that way. And the list of officers that they send into the General Service Office, that they list a greeter for the group. Can you imagine that? Don't know what they get unless it's penguins, but they got a greeter anyhow. I guess that what I want to talk about kind of boils down really to something that I heard when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was on a business trip down to Houston, Texas. I worked for a big oil company in New York at the time, and I was going down there on a business trip when I'd been sober maybe 6 months, and I was kind of apprehensive about taking a trip, you know, and what might happen. So my sponsor had told me to, as soon as I got down there, to get in touch with AA, so I did. As soon as I got in from the airport and into the hotel, I picked up the phone and I called the number for AA and found out that there was indeed a meeting out at one of the clubs there. And so I hopped in a cab and got out there, and I was kind of late. When I got out there, the meeting was already underway, and there was an old timer who was sort of chairing the meeting, and he was kind of laying it on him. And he said, just as I came in the door, he was saying, AA doesn't teach us how to handle our drinking. And that sort of got my curiosity and got my attention anyway. And he went on to say that AA doesn't teach us how to handle our drinking, that most of us knew that the way to handle our drinking was to stop. And if we didn't know that, well, there was always plenty of other people around to tell us that that was what we should do. And stopping isn't really the name of the game. I mean, all of us, most of us, I certainly, stopped drinking a number of times in my the worst of my alcoholic drinking, when I had to, for one reason or another. But I always went back to drinking. And so that's really the catch, is to not go back to drinking. And that's what this fellow was talking about at this meeting. He said, AA doesn't teach us how to handle our drinking. It teaches us how to handle sobriety. And that's what none of us could handle in the first place, and that's why we drank. You know, it was just like a light bulb going on in my head. I mean, it made the whole thing sort of clear to me, and it sort of changed my whole way of thinking about AA in all these years since, and that's really why I wanted to share it with you. And I think it's very useful and very helpful, this whole idea of AA teaching us how to handle sobriety, because I think it explains a lot of things to people outside the fellowship. I don't know about you, but with me, people will say to me, my goodness, you haven't had a drink in X number of years. Why do you still go to those meetings? And you know, that's kind of hard to answer. Because I don't have a drinking problem. And I haven't had a drinking problem for about 20 years. And I don't have a drinking problem as long as I stay away from that first drink and go to meetings. We all know that. But I do have the problem of dealing with sobriety every cotton-picking day of my life. And that's really what the AA program is all about, isn't it? As one of my friends says, there isn't a single chapter in the big book that tells you how to stop drinking. There isn't a single page, there isn't a single paragraph in the big book that tells you how to stop drinking. What it tells you is how to live so that you don't have to go back to drinking. And that's really, to me, what it's all about. Now, to tell you a little bit about what it's like and what happened and what it's like now, Betsy and I are both from Kansas, as she mentioned today. There was nothing unusual about my youth. I came from parents who, they didn't have any money because it was depression years, but they did their very best for me, and we certainly were comfortable and a happy family and no alcohol problems in our family. The only thing that was unusual at all was that I was an only child, and we do hear that once in a while from these platforms. The other thing that was unusual was that my father moved around a lot. In fact, we moved a total of 18 times between the time that I was born and the time that I finally got to high school. The effect of that was that when we would come into a new town or a new neighborhood and I would go to a new school, here I was, a shy, introverted, skinny kind of a kid. And when I would get to school, of course, the other boys at the school would test you, which really meant beating you up. And so I spent a fair amount of time as a kid getting beat up. And I don't say that in any way to complain and or to give you an idea that I had an unhappy childhood, because I didn't really at all, except that in this new location, it would take me a long time before I would really start making friends and before I really felt that I belonged in this new place. And about the time that I got a friend or two and really felt good, why, then Dad would pull up stakes and we'd move on and this whole thing would be repeated in a new location. Now, what happened, I think, and I think this is important to what happened to me later in my alcoholism, the effect of this really was that I retreated into a dream world. I did an awful lot of daydreaming and an awful lot of what in the adult world we call fantasizing. This, I think, just made me a sitting duck for booze when it came along. And I continued throughout all of my drinking to fantasize everything. I was saying at dinner to somebody that, I never knew who I was because I was playing so many roles all the time that I never knew which one was the real me, if any. And I suspect that if any is more the answer. The other thing that this kind of environment had on me was that I got to be an overachiever. I got a lot of strokes from my family for good things in school, and so I did pretty well in school. When I left school and went on to college, I had decided that I was going to be a writer. In my last year of college, I sold an article to a national magazine, the old Scribner's magazine. Not only did I get paid for it then, but the Reader's Digest picked it up and ran it. It was a controversial kind of an article, and so darned if some of the columnists of the day, including Ed Sullivan and Walter Winchell and people like this, picked it up, and they wrote about this. They wrote about me. Here I am sitting out in Kansas, and they're writing about me. So this, I mean, for about a week, I was a kind of a celebrity. And so this was very heady stuff, you know, for a 20-year-old who's already started to drink, you know, like you do, the beer busts and that sort of thing in college. And it just fed this image that I had of myself. This fantasy world of mine, I not only read a lot of books, but I also saw a lot of movies, no television in those days, of course, so I did see a lot of movies, and boy, I, in my fantasy, I really imagined myself in the role of whoever was the hero of whichever movie I was looking, and particularly those that showed the glamorous life in New York. And you know, I could really identify with, I could picture myself as the Fred Astaire type, you know, with a top hat and white tie and tails and waltzing Ginger Rogers around Central Park. And so that's the image that I had of the life that I was going to lead just as soon as I got out of school and as soon as I went back to New York and wrote the great American novel or the great American play and became the man about town in New York. So as soon as school was out, I headed back for New York. It was the midst of the recession, and jobs were tough to find, but I did find a writing job, a writing and editing job, and it was for a company magazine of a big company, the same company that I worked for the next 33 years, which is a tribute either to their enormous tolerance or their complete ignorance of alcoholism, and I think, again, that it was more their ignorance. But the only thing that happened there really was that I got in with a lot of older people. I was 21 years old at this time, and most of the people that were working around me, of course, were my associates there, were at least in their 30s, and they were used to going down to the glamorous bars and around Rockefeller Center, which is where the office was. They would have cocktails after work, and they would have martinis or Manhattans, and so I fell into the habit of going down after work and having drinks with them. Most natural thing in the world, and no problems, except that I did have some warning signs that almost immediately began to develop. I had some blackouts. I remember one night I started with a couple of Manhattans downstairs, and I remember nothing else about the whole evening. And then I learned the next day that, my God, we'd gotten in a car and we'd driven clear over to Staten Island and back over to Long Island, and I had no recollection of any of this. But that's just sort of amusing at that stage in life. And then I was dating a girl who lived out in Brooklyn. That was when Brooklyn was, you know, a lot better than it is now. And I lived in Manhattan, and we would have a big evening in Manhattan, and then we'd get on the subway, and I would take her back out to Brooklyn, and quite a ways out there, you know. And after I took her home in the middle of the night, well, I would get back on the subway to head back for Manhattan. And the next thing you know, they would be shaking me or kicking the soles of my feet and saying, end of the line, buddy, end of the line, get up. And I'd be clear up in the far north part of the Bronx, at the very end of the line. And so I would stagger across the platform, and I'd get on another train, and I would head back for Manhattan again. And the next thing I know, they would be shaking me, kicking my feet, and saying, Coney Island, get off, get on another train, head back for Manhattan, back to the Bronx. And I would spend a whole night doing this. Now, this is, you know, it's not normal, I guess, but it certainly didn't alarm me. Well, along came the war, World War II, and I went in the Navy. I was commissioned in the Navy as a writer. And then, I went in before the war had started. And when Pearl Harbor came along, why, all of us who were stationed on shore, we went to sea, and I became a gunnery officer on a destroyer escort, and at the end of the war came out as a lieutenant commander, which, you know, again, is kind of my perfectionism and overachieving. But it was in the war years that I got into the first trouble that I ever got in for drinking and suffered the first discipline. And this happened when we were over in the Azores on a convoy trip. And we had to lay over there, and a bunch of us had gone sightseeing during the day. We'd hired an open-air native taxi cab, and we had a bunch of native wine, and we went bombing around that island, waving the wine, you know, and downing it, and got back pretty looped to the town of Horta that night, and I switched to this native brandy that tastes exactly like kerosene, and I downed a lot of that, and it was again the middle of the night when I caught the last gig back to the ship, and I was in terrible shape, and I lost control of myself when I got on board the ship, and I made a mess of my cabin and a mess of the wardroom, and I found myself up before captain's mast the next day, shivering and shaking and standing at attention, while the captain saying, "You're a good officer, Pearson, but you drink too much." and 3 days in hack was what he gave me. And that meant that when I got to New York, where I really wanted to have a good time, and where Bessie was waiting for me, and we were courting at this time, when I got there, where I really would have enjoyed myself, I was in my cabin, locked in with an armed Marine guard standing outside. Well, in the last year of the war, Betsy and I got married, and got a few days leave from the ship, and we took our honeymoon over in the mountains over in Pennsylvania, in a beautiful resort over there. And just to give you an idea of how I was making these childhood fantasies come true and the way that I was going to live my life, I'll tell you that during that entire honeymoon, my honeymoon friends there, during that entire honeymoon, we had iced champagne in a silver bucket sitting by the bedside day and night for the 4 or 5 days that we were there. And that's the way that I pictured that my life was going to be when the war was over. Well, the war did get over, and I came back to New York, and we settled in an apartment there, and I simply began to pick up the daily drinking, which I had started in 1938, I guess. I started being a daily drinker, and except for those war years, I was a daily drinker for all the rest of my alcoholic life until I got to AA. Now, at about this time, I found that I was having trouble coping with life. I had a terrible time with the tremors. I mean, I had shakes worse than you can imagine. And in fact, they really weren't the shakes, they were the leaps. And I couldn't really know when I reached for a glass whether I was going to grasp the glass or knock the glass over, you know. And, you know, God forbid that I would have to eat soup, for example. I would get a spoonful of soup, you know, and I would get it up to about here, and that nervousness would hit me, and I would start shaking like this and shake it all over. And so, of course, I quit eating soup. And I really didn't associate this shaking so much, well, really not at all, with drinking. I just had a tough time with this shaking. I also was having trouble with things like a kind of a quickness to anger, and I was having a devil of a time trying to cope with criticism. Now, as I say, I'm a writer, and all writers have editors, and the job of all editors is to criticize the work of writers. That's what they're paid for. But to me, boy, I really had a tough time coping with this. It hurt me. I got resentful. And I learned pretty soon that if I took a drink, that I really didn't care too much what the editor did to my writing. I also learned that when I had the shakes, if I took a drink, boy, just calm would come over me, and I could do anything that anybody else could do. I could drink soup, I could, you know, reach for a glass or anything. And boy, once I discovered this, my friends, I was really hooked. I could never again not be under the influence of alcohol because I just couldn't cope with life. I couldn't do the things that other people could do unless I had booze in me. So I was also using it for other things, of course. As I say, I was shy and introverted, and still was, though I covered it up a great deal. When we went out for parties or social gatherings or anything, of course I had to fortify myself with a couple of drinks so I could really be at ease, you know, with the social engagement. Or if I was making a business presentation, of course I had to have a couple of belts to fortify myself. And of course the catch is that you had to be pretty careful not to over-fortify yourself to the point that you might slur your words as you were presenting, or that you might stumble when you left the platform. And I had trouble with these things too. In fact, I really made an ass of myself on more than one occasion. I was having trouble with lying. Gary mentioned this the other night. I guess maybe this is something we all have trouble with. I was lying when I didn't have to lie, or even there was no advantage to lying. And, you know, I'd been brought up to that... my word is my bond, and a gentleman's word is always kept, and all of this kind of thing. And now I found myself lying even when I didn't want to. Just simple things about where I'd been, or what I'd been doing, or why I wasn't at work on time, or whatever. But, you know, these things kind of eat away at us alcoholics. I have an old friend, one of the real old-timers in AA in New York, that says... we alcoholics have a goosey conscience, and I buy that. I think we do, and I think we have a very sensitive conscience that makes us very uncomfortable when we do something that we know is wrong, and that's what I was doing. Well, this trouble with coping with life in all these various ways, as I say, I didn't particularly associate with alcohol, but I was still having the trouble, and about that time we got transferred down to New Orleans, and as Betsy said this afternoon, she didn't say it in these words, but I'll tell you, I went down with a real bad drinking problem. I mean, I was an alcoholic, all right, but you would have described me, I guess, as a very heavy drinker when I went down to New Orleans. We were down there 1 year, and I came back a raging alcoholic. I was drinking around the clock. I had been drinking in the morning for years, but I mean, I really was drinking so hard that I was beginning to have all kinds of trouble, both with my personal life, my business life, and everything. And it was during this time when I was in this kind of all day long drinking pattern, that I, I want to tell you one thing that did happen, not right at this time, but a little bit later, that might illustrate the kind of problems, the kind of ways that I was coping with life. And this happened when Betsy's parents, who lived back in Salina, Kansas, were celebrating their 50th wedding anniversary. And they had come back to our part of the country to celebrate. And as I say, I'm this only child, and I have married into this family, which is very large and very loving. And they all love me, and I love them, but still, I get in the midst of them, and it's always better to have a couple of drinks, just to feel a little more comfortable. There were some 30 people coming back all together at our house and next door for this wedding anniversary. So, this was at a kind of a bad time, and Betsy, who all through our marriage was a kind of an instinctive Al-Anon, although she didn't go to Al-Anon in those days, she sort of detached from my drinking as best she could, and she never bugged me about my drinking. She never scolded me or gave me any grief about it. But this particular morning, she did say to me, as I got up, now I was living in Connecticut and working in New York by now, and as I got up in Connecticut and we were down for breakfast was an ordeal, I tell you. I had long since quit eating breakfast, and I just couldn't even face the food, but I would push the food around on the plate while we were talking. And she said, "Now, dear," she said, "you know how terribly important this occasion is tonight. And she said, I hope that just today you won't have too big a lunch." Now, that's a code, you see, I guess. At least I knew what she meant, and she knew that I knew what she meant. And you know what happened. I got into town that day, and I had a very big lunch indeed. No food, but a very big lunch indeed. And went on through the afternoon, had a couple of drinks on the way home on the bar car, on the train, and of course by the time that I got off the train, I was in no good shape. My coat was buttoned up wrong, you know, like this, and my hat sitting on the side of my head, and I'm staggering down off the train. And I know that it's breaking Betsy's heart, but she was kind of cool. We got back to the house, and everybody was gathered in the patio out in back of the house. And, of course, I made a beeline for the bar, the pantry where the bar is set up, because, of course, I did need a drink. And so I got the drink, and, again, I don't remember really anything about what happened for the next, half hour maybe. But around that length of time, they haul me out from under the grand piano, where I have taken refuge, clutching this drink to my chest, because I know that if they get me, they're going to take it away from me. And they did. And as a matter of fact, they sent me to my room for the rest of the evening. Now, I was 44 years old at that time. So it was while I was coping with life in this way that I discovered that I had a growth in my abdomen. Now, I was a lot different in those days. I weighed about 35 pounds more than I do now, and I had a lot more girth and a lot more pouches and yellow eyes and a lot of broken blood vessels in my face, and I was a kind of a mess, really. But in this distended abdomen of mine, I felt this very hard lump getting bigger and bigger, and it scared me to death, of course. And so I screwed up my courage, and I went to our family doctor, and he laid me down, and he felt around, and he asked me a question, which was a great surprise to me. It probably won't be to many people in this room. He said, Bob, he said, how much do you drink? Well, unlike many of the stories that I have heard, I didn't have the mental agility, I guess, to really quickly say something like, oh, just a couple. But I really tried to kind of total up what I was drinking. And I said, oh, 8 or 9 drinks a day. And what I didn't tell him was that for many years by this time, I had experimented with all kinds of drinks, as they said in the third chapter that was read here last night, I guess, or this morning. I had finally settled on 100-proof vodka chased with Ballantine's ale, which is a kind of a Russian boilermaker. And it really did the job. And it was about 8 or 9 of these that I was having every day. And the doctor, who turned out later to be one of these kind of abstemious people, you know, who might have a drink a week, I suppose, he was a little bit shocked by this, and he said, every day? And I said, sure, every day. And he said, I think we know what's wrong. And so he took a liver function test, and sure enough, I had a badly damaged liver, and this was the distended liver, of course, that was giving me the trouble in my abdomen. So the doctor set me down, and he really read the riot act to me. I mean, he gave me the standard lecture that some of us can drink and some of us can't, and that alcohol is poison to those of us who can't, and that we really should see a skull and crossbones on the label of every bottle that we look at, and that I had to quit drinking, and that if I didn't, he described that I would die a horrible death, and described it. And he scared me sufficiently that I quit drinking right then. And I stayed dry for a period of about 10 months. And I want to emphasize that, you see, because that's exactly what this old boy down in Houston was saying when I went to that AA meeting. That at a time in my life when I would have told you that I couldn't possibly stay away from a drink for 2 hours without absolutely crawling the walls, at a time when I was having nightmares over the fact that maybe sometime I would go in the hospital or maybe get in jail or something where I couldn't get a drink, and I knew that I would absolutely go out of my skin if that happened to me. At that period, when the doctor scared me enough, I quit drinking. And I was pretty sick at that time, and it took me a while to recover physically. I was out of work for a little while, and then got better and went back on an increasing basis, and the months went by, and I kept going back to the office, the doctor's office, to get these tests, and I was getting a lot of vitamins and the things that they give you. And at the end of about 10 months, when I went to the doctor, he took the test and he set me down and he said, you've merely made a remarkable recovery. And he said, your liver's about as good as it's ever going to be. And he said, you don't have to come back anymore. Well, this is the time that I had been kind of waiting for. And ever so casually, I said to him, well, John, does this mean that, oh, on a hot summer's day when I've been out cutting the lawn, I might have a cold beer? And he looked a little surprised, and I said, or perhaps a fine wine with dinner, which was a crock, you know. I never had a fine wine with dinner. Maybe a Russian Boilermaker with dinner, but that was my style. John, he didn't know anywhere near as much about alcoholism then as he was to know later. And so he said those fatal words to the alcoholic. He said, well, Bob, one won't hurt you. So I thanked him and I left the office and I drove right back home. And you know something? By the time that I got home, that comment of his had been translated into the following. I burst into the door and I said, Betts, guess what? John says I can drink again. And of course, she was delighted to hear this. I took the train into town and went down to the English Grill Bar, which was my regular watering place, and I said to Sam, the bartender, I said, set them up, Sam, we're in business again. And so he set them up, and I had my drink, and it didn't hurt me. My God. How about that? And you know the story. It was another, maybe a week before I had another drink, and it didn't hurt me. And then another, a matter of weeks, it was the Christmas season, and people were giving Christmas parties. And, if one doesn't hurt you, and it certainly didn't, at a Christmas party, two isn't going to hurt you. And so I had a couple. And Christmas passed, and I went on a business trip, and business trips were always bad news for this alcoholic. I went on this business trip for, a couple of weeks at least. And something happened that was really should have scared me, and that is I really didn't want to drink again like I had drunk before. And yet when I came back from that business trip, I was just as desperate, round-the-clock drinking alcoholic as I had been months and months and months before when I had gone to that doctor. It had come back to me worse than ever right then and there, just like that. Well, for the next 2 years, I continued to drink, only much worse, all the time. Progression had really set in. And particularly it was bad because I had to go underground. I had always loved to go to the fancy bars, in New York, and the University Club and the Stork Club and all of these kind of places, because this was the way that I had always pictured that I was going to live. And drinking in these kind of places was in line with this kind of an image that I had of myself. Now, I had to not drink publicly because I wasn't supposed to be drinking. Now, I had long since come to the time of hiding bottles, and my regular pattern was, and for a long time before this, had been to buy in New York. They have some kind of a law that you have to buy, if you buy less than a half pint, what they call nips, 4 ounces, you have to buy flavored liqueurs, lemon-flavored vodka was the one that I always bought. And I would get these nips, and I would have them stowed away in my suits and my coats, and that was my ready supply. Well, now, that wasn't enough. I continued to have that, but that just plain wasn't enough. And so I really had to carry a full bottle with me at all times. And that meant that I had to keep it in a briefcase that I kept with me. And I would get on that commuter's train in the morning, you know, with my briefcase, and if I was lucky, I would have already had a nip in the kitchen before I got to the car, and Betsy took me to the station. But I would get into town on that train, hoping that nobody would speak to me. I was shaking and I was sweating, and I was full of really anger and hostility and loathing and all this kind of thing, and I just didn't want to talk to anybody. And it seemed like the train would take forever to get into New York, right, you know, through the Bronx and through Harlem and down into the middle of New York. And I would get out of the train as quick as I could, and I would beat it across Grand Central Station, and I would go down the stairs into that grimy, grimy men's room and into a stall and get that briefcase open and get the paper bag out and get the top off of the vodka, you know, and get it up to my lips, going down my chin and down my clothes, just so I could get enough in me so that I could drag my way over to the office. And of course, I had to keep drinking as the day went on, at least every couple of hours. And again, I couldn't risk keeping the bottle in my desk or in drinking in my office. I couldn't go downstairs to the English Grill during the coffee break, which had been my habit to do for years. No, the only place that I could drink there was in the men's room, which meant that I had to carry the briefcase with me every single time that I went into the men's room. I was sick and I was insane. At the end of a couple of, well, let me tell you that I got a lot sicker, really. Because, of course, the cirrhosis of the liver, which I had been on the verge of, it really hit me now. And your liver manufactures a substance that causes your blood to clot. And if you're a cirrhosis victim, then your blood doesn't clot. And you become a bleeder. And I became a terrible bleeder. I had nosebleeds, for example, that you just wouldn't believe. Two times I had to be removed from my office, once in a wheelchair and once on a stretcher, because of bad nosebleeds that they couldn't stop. And they took me down to an infirmary, and they would cauterize it up in there, and they would stuff cotton up, and then they would stuff gauze up to the point that it made it very difficult to drink. I developed bruises all over my body, spontaneous bruises, great big angry blue and purple and green and yellow bruises. And part of it was that, of course, I was falling down and I was falling into things and I was stumbling over furniture and that kind of thing all the time. But part of it was just spontaneous bruising, because your blood vessels give way underneath your skin and you just get great big blotches of blood underneath your skin is what happens. And this is a very bad sign, and the doctor kept warning me whenever he would see me that I only had, you know, not a year, not months, but maybe weeks to live, and I just couldn't believe him. I figured that I could beat the system, and so I just, desperate, went right on drinking. And I went on a business trip, and this was difficult because I was very weak. And as a matter of fact, there was a water faucet in our house that turned pretty hard, and I got to the point I couldn't turn the hot water off and on. I was that weak. And I couldn't travel very well. I was traveling by train in those days because I couldn't handle my luggage. Didn't have the strength to lift up the luggage and, you know, get it into the train. But nevertheless, I was on this business trip, and it was out to Chicago, and I was really carousing, in the words of my dear departed mother. She was a great lover of the word carouse, and I was carousing, all right, out in Chicago for 3 or 4 days. I was working during the day and up all night. And it would have killed anybody, let alone a sick person like I was. And sure enough, at the end of that time, what the doctor had warned me about happened to me. And that is that I had a massive esophageal hemorrhage. I lost about half the blood in my body in about 2.5 hours, losing it rectally, vomiting it, bleeding every way that you can imagine. I went kind of in and out of consciousness. I really didn't know what to do. I do remember in the afternoon I was dressed and I was sitting over in a park across from the Blackstone Hotel. It was in October and it was a bleak kind of a cold day anyway. And boy, I was in my conscious moments when I wasn't going behind a bush to throw up this blood and so on. I knew I was dying, and I was really wallowing in self-pity over it. I was thinking to myself, well, it's just as well that I am dying, because Betsy's young and pretty, and she'll get another husband, and he'll be a better father to my children than I am. And I was just, you know, just wallowing in this kind of garbage. And yet, I was thinking at the same time, God, here I am lonely, you know, I'm 1,300 miles from home, and I'm in Chicago. And who wants to die in Chicago? So I let the hotel call our house doctor, and he was a hard-bitten old boy who had seen this kind of thing before, I guess. He asked me a couple of questions and poked me a couple of times, and the next thing I know, the sirens are coming down the street outside, and they come up and they roll me off of the bed, which I was on by this time, dressed only in my socks and my shorts, I might add. And they rolled me off on this stretcher and rigged up the, you know, the field kit of blood transfusions as they're carrying me out through the Blackstone Hotel lobby. Very undignified, believe me. And I get in the ambulance and I'm taken off to a hospital. I didn't even know what hospital I was in for 2 or 3 days. I wake up in the morning and they got both my hands tied down, you know, and they've got intravenous feeding going into one arm and blood transfusions going into the other. And over the next several days, I get I don't know how many pints of somebody else's blood. And after I've had this much of somebody else's blood, I begin to perk up pretty well. I begin to feel pretty good. And so they discharged me pretty soon. They told me that I could go back home. I had, of course, been in touch by this time with my company and with Betsy. And so I went back home to Connecticut. But before I went, again, this doctor, in fact, more than one doctor at the hospital, again, set me down, and they made it quite clear. I mean, they didn't lecture me. They just said, if you ever take another drink, it may well be your last. But they didn't tell me about AA. They didn't tell me that it was the first drink that got me drunk. They gave me no help whatsoever in dealing with having to deal with criticism or with anger or with any of the other things that trouble us as alcoholics. And so when I went back home, I still had to cope with life, only now it was without any booze, and it was difficult. And after a couple of months, it was football season, and I love football, and we were going to a football game up in New Haven. And, you know, friends, who ever heard of going to a football game without a drink? So, not having the benefit of AA, I took that first drink. And, of course, you know what happened. The compulsion immediately set in, and again, within a matter of weeks, I was just as bad as before, and worse, going downhill all the time. Well, to make a long story a little bit shorter, within a couple of months, I had another massive esophageal hemorrhage. This time it was at home, and I went to the Greenwich Hospital. And I would like to just tell you something that happened to me just about a year ago. I was going back to Greenwich Hospital. This is just recently. And it was for a big deal. I think I was taking a mole off of my chest. And but I still had to, you know, have it done in a sort of an outpatient room there. And so they were taking my name and address for a place to send the bill. And there was a nice gray-haired nurse who was taking this down. And as I spoke to her, she took my name, and she said, I know you. And I said, oh, you do? And she said, aren't you a friend of so-and-so? And she named AA there in town. And I said, yeah. And she said, I remember you when you were in here 20 years ago. And I said, how in the name of heaven could you remember me with the thousands and thousands and thousands of patients that you have treated in those years? And she said, I remember you because we rang a code 500 on you. And I said, what is a code 500? And she said, it means that the patient is dying. And it brings the oxygen and all the available floor doctors and the priest and everybody. And she said, and you didn't die. And I said, well, sure, I obviously didn't, but I said, that can't be that unusual. With all these people that you have treated for the same thing, I mean, it can't be all that bad. She said, oh, yeah. She said, they all die. Just like that. They all die. You know, I've got to believe in my own heart and soul that my higher power was sparing me for something else. And as Gary and I were sharing today, I hope that it's for this very moment that he was sharing, that he was sparing me for. But at any rate, I did make my peace with my maker that night, really. And of course, since then, I've worked with many alcoholics who have had the same kind of trouble, because people are always, you know, getting me to meet them, and so they can identify with somebody. And I can tell you, I don't know of anybody. I know of no one, nor do I know of any doctor who has ever known anyone who has survived more than two of these massive esophageal hemorrhages and live to tell the tale. The life expectancy certainly is not there. So I have been spared. Well, my doctor, soon after... Oh, I must tell you one more thing about that little visit. I, again, got a lot of blood transfusions and intravenous feeding. And again, at the end of about 4 or 5 days, why, they said, you're ambulatory. And so I got out of bed, and I pulled on my pants and my shirt and my shoes, and I ambulated out of the hospital and down to the corner liquor store and got a bottle of vodka, and I smuggled it back into the hospital and stuck it in the waste basket and was sucking away on it with the bandages still on my arms. When Betsy called me, actually, from home, and, you know, like most good wives, she could tell 50 miles away when I'd had a drink, and from the other end of the wire, you know, she knew that I had been drinking. She called the doctor, and she said, John, she said, Pierce has been drinking. And John said, no, he's in the hospital. She said, yeah, but I know, you know, she couldn't convince him, but she was right and he was wrong. So anyway, I got out of there, and the doctor, my good doctor, who had been through all this with me, he quit on me. He said, I can no longer be responsible for your life, and I'm giving you up as a patient. And he said, you really have to go to a psychiatrist. And so I was in no position to argue at that point, and so I said, okay, and although I didn't think I was crazy, and... So he sent me to a psychiatrist who happened to practice in the same suite of offices as my doctor, John Bolton. And that's the only reason that he sent me to this particular psychiatrist, is because he practiced in this same suite of offices. But my friends, this is where I think my higher power was certainly operating, because the name of the man that he sent me to was Dr. Harry Thiebaud. Can you imagine that? I mean, this was the one professional in the world who knew more about alcoholism than anybody else at that time. And at that very time, he was serving as a non-alcoholic trustee on the General Service Board of Alcoholics Anonymous. But he, of course, didn't let me know that. He talked to me exactly twice, and then he called Betsy in. And he said, I cannot help your husband. And he said to her, he has an iron curtain pulled down between him and the rest of the world. And he said, I can't penetrate that iron curtain. The only thing that's going to save your husband is Alcoholics Anonymous. And then he called me in and he told me the same thing. And he had gotten me to admit by this time that I might be having trouble with booze. And believe me, I did not admit that I was an alcoholic, nor did I accept it. I was too sick to see reality, my friends. There was, it says there in the big book, you know, that we don't differentiate between the, between truth and unreality. And that's exactly the situation that I was in. And so he asked if he could call, a friend of his who, might be able to help me. And who was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my reply to him was, oh, I wouldn't want to bother him. And Dr. Tebow explained that Stu Jones, who was the man who was to become my sponsor, he wouldn't consider that a bother at all, that these strange people thought that it was a favor to be called to talk to another drunk because it helped keep them sober. So he called Stu, and Larry, I think of this when I hear the conferences and the other regional forums and so on occasionally debating, you know, whether AA should respond when it's the professional who calls and not the patient. But I can tell you that if Stu Jones hadn't responded to that call from Harry Tebow, I simply wouldn't be here tonight because I don't think I would have ever made the call. So anyway, that's what happened. And he took me to a few AA meetings, and they were marvelous meetings, and I loved the experience of going to AA, especially since it didn't particularly interfere with my drinking. I went right on, you know, fooling myself, not fooling anybody else, but I was still nipping away. But mind you, I was very mocus. I was very sick at this point. I was just too far gone, really, for this program to save me in time. It was at the end of that week, which was in July of 1961, and on July 3rd of that year, the town of Old Greenwich, Connecticut, was going to have their 4th of July fireworks demonstration. And our little family had been scheduled to go to this celebration along with several other families. We were going to have a little picnic first at somebody's house, and then we were all going down to this little park to see the fireworks demonstration. And so we did this, and as soon as we got to this other house, I spotted the host's vodka bottle back in the house, and everybody else was outside, and so I managed to find a reason to go into the house several times during the next hour or so, and so I was getting really drunker and drunker. And then it was time to pile into the car and go down to this little park for the fireworks display. And it was late, of course. It was already dark. The fireworks display was already going. And by the time that we got down there, all the parking places were taken for blocks around. And so I let the family out, and I went to park the car. And then I walked back, and when I got there, if we had made any arrangements to meet at any particular place, I certainly was too mocus to have remembered. And so I just set out to find the family. Now, I was very unsteady on my feet. I was hardly conscious, really. And so I would stumble out into this sea of people who were all sitting down on the grass on their blankets and had with their tablecloths and their little baby prams and all of that kind of thing. And I would stumble over these people. And then, boy, off would go this tremendous explosion up in the sky, and down would come these sparks of fire around me, you know. And in that moment of the explosion, I could look down, and here were the people looking up at me, you know, like this, very angry and disgusted. And then it would get real dark again, and I couldn't see my family, and so I was still stumbling along, and then, boy, off would go another one of these things, and more of this fire would come down. And believe me, my friends, that moment to me was just like a scene out of Dante's Inferno or something, you know? And then it goes, blam, 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 booey, booey. And all this stuff comes down, and it's the end of the fireworks demonstration. And the fireman's auxiliary band gets up and plays the Star Spangled Banner, and everybody gets up and folds their blankets and puts the kids in the carriages and go home. And I'm there. I'm thinking in my fog state, see, I still hadn't found family, and I thought, well, they must have gone to where the cars parked. Then I thought, that couldn't be, because they don't know where the cars parked. And then I realized I didn't know where the car was parked. And so I just trailed off after these people who were the last ones who were leaving the park, and I walked after them up a little hill near there. And when I got about halfway up, something that you people had been saying to me for the past week of AA meetings struck home. And I mean real down deep within me. And that was simply that my life was unmanageable. And my reaction to this was rather typical. I went over to the side of the road, and I sat down on a rock and cried. And with the tears streaming down my cheeks, that's where my sister-in-law found me, and she put her arms around me and said, "There, there, dear boy," and led me back to the car, where sure enough, the family'd found it all right. And they took me off home. And when I got home, I've got to tell you that there in the kitchen was your classic AA scene. Because a friend of mine, who was a drinking companion of mine, a daily drinking companion for years and years, lo and behold, he was sitting at my kitchen table with the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous spread out before him on the table. It was really like a poster or something of your classic 12th step scene. There was only one catch, and that is that he was drunker than I was. He had come to AA in the last week, and he had been down at the fireworks display, and he had seen me stumbling around, and he was making his first 12 step call. Now, the beautiful thing about this is that about 7 years later, Don did come into AA himself, and I was his sponsor. And he's sober today. Well, the next morning, I was confronted as I came downstairs on July 4th of 1961 by this homemade intervention that Betsy had cooked up. She had called my boss and gotten me a final leave. In fact, he said he can have a leave, an indefinite leave for health reasons, but if he doesn't straighten up, don't come back. And she had contacted long since my minister, and she had contacted the doctor, and the doctor was over there. This is July 4th, and he had made a house call. You know how serious that was. And so here they were, as somebody said today in this conversation to which I had not been invited, they were discussing where they were going to send me. They were either going to put me in the state insane asylum or a sanitarium. Sanitariums were very big for alcoholics in those days. But somewhere along the line, at one of these AA meetings, a friend of mine at the AA had poked her finger in my chest, as we are likely to do with newcomers, and she said, "Where you belong is High Watch Farm," naming this drunk farm, which is famous enough that it's written up in AA Comes of Age. It's about as near to an AA-run place as is possible, even though AA, of course, cannot own it or run it. But it's the granddaddy of all the treatment centers, but the only treatment it's just AA. I mean, you just talk AA, you go to AA meetings, you get a heavy dose of AA, and it's remarkable. And with just that as a treatment, I mean, there are no doctors, no counselors, no nurses, no nothing, just food, a spiritual atmosphere, and AA. And people get well by the droves. And I did. When I got up there, I was so full of anger and resentments and self-pity and all this cesspool of emotions that we go through, you know, that I was, and nobody wanted to speak to me, and I didn't want to speak to them, and it was terrible. But after just 2 or 3 days, why, this iron curtain that I had between me and life began to dissolve a little, and this soul, if I had one, began to unfold a little bit. And with you people there to show me, I began to see that it might be possible, just possible, to live in life without drinking and to have a reasonably happy and productive life. And this, believe me, was an absolutely new idea to me at that point in my life. That idea had never crossed my mind before up to that point. And it was up there that I first got acquainted with the grapevine. And of course, I read the big book, and it was strongly suggested that we get immediately into the steps. And so I took all the steps one morning. And I'm sure many of you know what I mean there. But again, it's better not doing it at all, I tell you. It's very good, in fact. And at the end of a couple of weeks, they suggested that it was time that I go back into the real world. And so I went back and I affiliated with my home group in Greenwich, Connecticut. Began to go to meetings very regularly. Began to get active, very active, hyperactive. This is more Betsy's story than mine, but I led her a terrible pace for a couple of years because I was never home between AA and all the other things that I was doing. You know how we are, trying to make up for lost time, really. I just threw myself into life, just threw myself into everything. Just frantic, just frenetic. Crazy. But, of course, the program helps us deal with that, doesn't it? So, actually, it wasn't until I had been in AA for about 6 months, one night, that I was continuing to make Betsy drinks at night because she could drink and I couldn't. And she said that to me that night. She said, "You know, darling, it's terribly unfair that you keep making me these drinks and you can't drink." And suddenly it just came over me. And I said, "Betsy, why don't you just sit down here at the kitchen table," which she did. And I said, "You know, if there were some magic pill that would make it possible for me to go back to drinking tomorrow without any bad effects whatsoever on you or the family or my health or my job or anything, I just realized just now that I wouldn't do it. There was nothing left in drinking for me at that point." And that's an amazing thing, because this was not an act of will of mine. I did not will this. This is a gift from my God, that it was a complete release from the compulsion to drink. And I have never had the slightest compulsion since from that day to this. Now, I don't have time. I'm already over time. And I just don't have time to tell you all of the wonderful things that have happened to me since I have come into AA. But I do want to mention that for me, of course, one of the great benefits was simply health. I have become something of a physical fitness nut as my AA life has grown. And I do think there is a close correlation between physical health and mental health and spiritual health. And so now, from this blob that was lying in hospitals, being kept alive by somebody else's blood, why now I'm an avid skier in the wintertime and a sailor in the summertime, and every morning I get up and run from 2 to 4 miles. And I just got to tell you that this morning when I was out there running in this beautiful valley with the sun, well, it was dark really when I was out there, but as I came back, there was a little light in the eastern sky, and the birds were just beginning to sing, and I was running along that lovely river over there. And during this time each morning, it's time for me to take my 11th step. And I find that it's a good time for me to establish a close contact with my higher power and to thank Him for my sobriety and for all of the other beautiful things in my life, and to find out what He has in mind for me for the day. And to pray really for knowledge of His will and the power to carry it out. And that's what I was doing this morning, exactly as I do every day. And it was a beautiful, beautiful experience this morning. I can absolutely guarantee you. Our family relationship was quickly restored because Betsy joined Al-Anon at the same time that I joined AA. And she recovered with the same program that I did at the same time. And it has really been the basis of a beautiful, beautiful marriage. Now, we had a good marriage even through the worst of my drinking, because she was told to leave me and, you know, all this kind of thing. But she never did. She hung in there. And in spite of all the troubles that I gave her in my early days of sobriety, why, now our marriage has really matured on an entirely new basis, and a beautiful one. We have a lovely life together, and the children that I had really pretty much rejected and alienated myself from in the last of my drinking, they've of course grown up now and presenting us with grandchildren, and AA and Al-Anon has been such a big thing in their lives. My golly, I hear Betsy talking to our daughter out in Chicago now, and she's saying, oh, this too will pass, and one day at a time, and both of them are saying this. See, it's just coming right back at us. And boy, that's just a beautiful and wonderful thing that's happened. And I go out to Idaho where my two sons live, and here we are, three of us, three generations of us, skiing down the mountain in Idaho. God, you know, you have to be an alcoholic to get to this beautiful stage in life, really. And of course, I'm deeply grateful to every one of you, and to the delegates and the trustees and the others for the opportunity that you have given me to work for you. Because AA just means the world to me. It means everything to me. I love it. I love to be with AA people and to do things in AA. And now, can you imagine? I'm making my living. I'm paid to do the things that I would pay you to do if you'd take the money. Because I love the life so much, and I'm just deeply grateful to you for the opportunity that I've had for the last several years to be the manager of the General Service Office. And I guess I'd sum it up by saying that the greatest benefit that I have gotten, in summary, is that I'm able to handle sobriety. Right back to that again. And the way that AA teaches us how to do this is just simply too numerous to go over in any detail, but suffice to say that it helps us, first of all, to get rid of our guilt and our remorse. And I think most of us come in here with a pretty heavy load of that. And of course, we're told that we have to get rid of these kind of poisonous thoughts and replace them with good thoughts. And we are really freed from the burdens of the past by practicing the fourth step and the fifth step and the sixth and the seventh and the eighth and the ninth, really cleaning up the wreckage of the past. Clearing away the wreckage of the past. We are given the privilege of living a day at a time. I mean, so that we aren't burdened down by the burdens of the past and the anxieties of the future, but we really just live for one day. Now, this is nothing new, my friends. This is in the wisdom of the ages. And yet, we are the only people on the face of the earth, as far as I know, that devote hours of our every week to practicing and learning how to live for the moment, how to live for a day at a time, which is really getting a grasp on reality. We're granted the serenity to accept the things that we cannot change, and what a beautiful gift this is. This has helped to free me of this quickness to anger that I used to have, and the difficulty in dealing with criticism. Though I still have trouble with that. I mean, none of us is perfect. It's progress that we strive for. And you know, when I first came in here, you told me that I had to learn to differentiate between my wants and my needs. And boy, that was a great message to me and helped me enormously, because I was a great wanter. As I've indicated to you, I was a striver. I was an overachiever. I was ambitious. Whatever I got, it wasn't enough. I wanted something more. And so my wants were never satisfied. And that's what you told me. You said your wants will never be satisfied, but your needs will always be provided by a loving God. And that's been my experience, really, for the time that I have been in AA. But especially, of course, all of these things, all of the steps, all the tools of the program and the program itself really restores to us a contact with reality. And it frees me of the difficulty or the way that I had of coping with things, which was to fantasize. That was really the only way that I could ever deal with anything, was to fantasize about it. God, no matter what happened, I could go down to the English Grill and over those Russian Boilermakers, I could play this tape over and over and over in my head about what I would have done about it if I had done it right, or what I was going to do about it in some fantastic way, but clear out of touch with reality. And when I got into AA, you people taught me that we live in reality and with reality, but the most amazing thing is that we find that reality is beautiful, just like that sunrise this morning out here in the valley, and just like this very moment that I was being spared for, as I said before, where I can look out at you and see your loving, wonderful faces looking back up here at me. And this moment, which is really all the reality that we have, this breath and this moment, is perfectly beautiful. And I think it's especially beautiful for all of us, because I think that at last, maybe for the first time in our whole lives, when we get into AA, we're at peace. We're at peace with ourselves, and we're at peace with our fellow man, and we're at peace with God. And thank you.
I want to thank you, Bob. I have one short announcement to make before we close this meeting, and there will be a discussion meeting at Jackson Lodge tonight, starting probably about 11 o'clock, for anyone who wants to come. Bob, would you lead us in the Lord's Prayer?
Thank you very much.
Really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Hold hands if you wish. All those who care to, join me in the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, and the power, and the glory, forever. Amen.